Welcome, and thank you for listening to this recording, part of the Comprehensive Opioid Stimulant and Substance Abuse Program, or COSAP, podcast series. COSAP provides financial and technical assistance to states and units of local and Indian tribal governments to plan, develop, and implement comprehensive efforts to identify, respond to, treat, and support those impacted by the opioid epidemic. Since 2017, BJA has supported innovative work on these COSAP sites across the nation. Funding and programmatic support for COSAP is provided by the U.S. Department of Justice, Office of Justice Programs, Bureau of Justice Assistance, or BJA. The opinions expressed in this podcast are not necessarily those of the U.S. Department of Justice.
Hi, everyone, and thank you for joining us for episode 3. We will be continuing our discussion and speaking specifically about equitable programming with our guest speakers, Sadie Thompson of the Wellbeing Initiative, Inc., and Rich Alexander of the Burlington County Prosecutor's Office.
As we kind of move into episode 3, we're going to be discussing equitable programming. So we know how difficult health equity can be to achieve. And I'd like for both of you to talk about how your community or organization has worked to implement practices that provide consumers the opportunity to access the resources they may need. So that could look like healthcare or transportation. I think both of you have kind of touched on that already, education and things of that nature. Rich, would you begin that conversation for me?
Sure, I'd be glad to. So, you know, looking at health equity, it's really not easily achieved with, you know, when we're dealing with people that have state-funded insurance or people with no insurance. You know, I'm really not a politician, so I may say things that politicians wouldn't say, that, you know, there's a hierarchical system here. So not surprisingly, people with state-funded Medicaid or no insurance don't get the same level of treatment as those with private insurance. And I've even witnessed how emergency departments release people with state insurance in hours where people with the same issue in private insurance are admitted to the hospital. And unfortunately, you know, we really have no influence on this at all. So, you know, what can we do, you know, is we ensure that those we encounter get the services they need and deserve in line with what's available to them. You know, we teach our program participants to advocate for themselves, right? Because we can't be there with them when they're in front of an admissions counselor or, you know, when they're at the detox. So it's much easier, you know, for someone with private insurance to get inpatient treatment post-detox. You know, however, you know, we've learned that there's residential beds available to those that don't have private insurance. So when we have people that are interested, you know, and they're saying, oh, I've done this before and it's only worked, you know, when I've gone to extended treatment. So we start coaching them and to bring this up in each conversation they're in when they're at detox. And I've even joked with people that, you know, when you're at the intake and you're talking and they ask your name, don't tell them your name. First tell them you want to get a residential bed once your detox is complete, then tell them your name. And to bring it up in every conversation while they're there at treatment. And we even have them, we request they sign a release, you know, to talk with our peer recovery specialist to speak with them. And then, you know, and then our focus could be on these calls where we're discussing, you know, their discharge plan. We're really not interested in, you know, any clinical aspect of that. You know, it's just not our area of expertise. We really want to know, you know, we're really looking to avoid situations we run into and we help deal with. But, you know, someone calls us like, oh, I'm home. I just got home from detox 2 hours ago and, you know, my family doesn't want me to stay here. Can you help me? So we're really looking to avoid that. And unfortunately, you know, it's one of those situations where people have to advocate for themselves.
Yeah, I think that's a great point.
Yes, yes. The advocating for themselves is something we really have to teach them. And some people aren't really, you know, they feel that it's not their role, but you know, it's something that, you know, people who have been through the system, then they learn they have to advocate for themselves. They know what we're talking about. And then, you know, with transportation, you know, fortunately for us, you know, we can provide transportation to anyone that we come in contact with in our programs. I throw that in, you know, when I'm talking to people that, you know, especially those with not a high level of interest, you know, but I know that they're dealing with homelessness and they're dealing, you know, they don't have transportation and they don't have people that can get them to where they're going, is that I let them know, like, I can, if you get yourself into treatment or if I get you into treatment, I can get you there. And that becomes something that builds a relationship. So they want to stick with me because people, they really don't have access to transportation. So any reason for them to work with me works, you know, works fine by me. And so they get themselves into treatment. That's fine with us. So, you know, this definitely builds a relationship between our peers and the participants. And then they're really extremely grateful, you know, when they do get a ride. And you know, this, they can get a ride home from treatment through the state, but getting someone immediately to treatment through the state is practically impossible. So we handle that, we fill that gap. And then, you know, this really proves to them that we'll do whatever we can to support them. And this helps, you know, the continuation of the peer-to-peer relationship. And regarding education, our program is offered training on goal setting and resumes and going back to college. And we honestly found limited desire for these programs. You know, we found people are more interested in these programs are the peer recovery specialists we employ. They seem to be at a different, you know, level of their recovery. And, you know, maybe they're a few years down the road and they start seeing that they want more than, you know, they start seeing the future for themselves as a peer recovery specialist. They start to see like, oh, maybe I can become a clinician. I always wanted to do such and such. So those are the ones that seem to be more interested in that. And, you know, but at this point, you know, we really haven't been offering educational support, but anybody who would be looking for it, you know, and brought that up to their recovery coach or their peer recovery specialist, you know, they could definitely focus on that as a goal. You know, especially educational goals. We're all for that. And, you know, personally, I've done that in recovery myself, where it took me, when I got into recovery, it took me 13 years to get an undergraduate degree in my recovery. And then, you know, only like 4 or 5 years later was I able to get an advanced degree. So, you know, and I know many people who've gone through that and I've coached many people through that, but people that we're mainly dealing with, you know, that doesn't seem to be their stage of recovery.
I think that's a fair perspective. You know, you got to have one thing at a time. You don't want to put too many things on your plate because that becomes distracting. And you want to make sure that you're here in your recovery and in the moment and focusing on what you need to get done. But I appreciate that. I think it's also a good point to talk about peer recovery coaches and peer recovery support specialists teaching people how to advocate for themselves when, you know, they are in a situation where maybe it takes too long for someone else to get there. So those are great life skills to have. And I think that's a really, really great point to make.
Thank you. Thank you.
Sadie, would you talk about how folks within your community have been impacted on the lack of transportation or how you guys have kind of combated that or access to healthcare needs or things of that nature?
Sure. So I think that health equity is just something that we take as an organization very seriously. Just as a peer-run organization, that's what one of the main issues that people with lived experience face. And so the first thing that we do is we make sure that we hire diversely. And that doesn't just mean people of different racial or ethnic backgrounds, but people with different lived experiences and like a variety of different types of lived experiences. So we have people that have experience with family members. We have people that have experienced specifically with substance use or primarily with mental health, or we have someone who specializes in neurodiversity and autism, and making sure that when we're hiring, we're doing that strategically so that we have a wide variety of people and experiences to draw from as an organization. And physical health challenges as well as physical disabilities is a part of that. So a part of our strategic plan too is to match diversity to our geographic location. So wherever we might have staff located, we want our staff to represent the area that they're working in. So right now in, I think, Lincoln, we're sitting at about 39% non-white. And so that's our goal in for our Lincoln office. We have a large population of Hispanic individuals in central Nebraska. We have a large population of Spanish-speaking individuals across Nebraska. And so we incentivize hiring people that speak both Spanish and English, and we're interpreting our peer support training in Spanish so that we can have primarily Spanish-speaking peer support specialists in Nebraska. We make sure that we extend specific training for cultural centers. So we always partner first with cultural centers in our locations to make sure that we're lifting up those voices and serving those populations at least as equally as everyone else, if not more so, because they are at a disadvantage for health equity. And then our staff are all always encouraged to participate in work groups and things like that. So all of our peer support specialists can provide transportation to their participants to appointments, or can support them in developing skills for their own transportation through our bus systems, or getting access to, you know, Medicaid waivers that allow them to get rides places for appointments. And so that's kind of a given here, but we also encourage our navigators to participate in any health equity work groups, like with the public health departments, or when Division of Behavioral Health is looking to create a work group or committee to represent the consumer voice regarding a certain topic, we always have somebody in there for that to make sure that our voice is being heard and that we're making changes where possible, as well as just supporting the infrastructure that already exists to get people to where they need to be for their healthcare needs.
That sounds wonderful, especially to be able to partner individuals who have lived experience with individuals who are currently experiencing that. Is such a unique perspective that they are so lucky to have, to be able to tailor that to them. I'm sure that has to be very impactful and rewarding for you to see.
Yeah, we really see when somebody can say, I have very similar experience to you, more engagement and excitement about participating and hope. You know, if you've been through more things like I've been through, I have more likelihood to think that recovery is possible for me too.
Absolutely. And, you know, just hearing the both of you speak, it speaks volumes about how important rapport is. And the more rapport you have with someone, just the inherent trust that's going to continue to grow. We've kind of touched on this briefly in our earlier conversations about data collection and program evaluation. And we know how important that is, especially when we're looking for that community buy-in. Could you talk to me about what you all do as an organization, Sadie, for your data collection effort?
Yeah, so this is really an area that we have put a lot of focus into recently. We are currently hiring actually a program coordinator that is directly responsible for data collection. We also are creating a membership model for anybody engaging in any of our services that allows us to collect basic information so that we are able to report different types of outcomes based on different demographics and different geographic location. All of that is something that we have worked with a program evaluator in the past on and are trying to bring in-house. And so basic survey tools that have already been established are actually few and far between. So we're working with some PhD students as well to try to develop some more appropriate data collection tools for peer recovery services to show the benefit of these services and the evidence for them, because everybody wants to fund evidence-based practices. We know peer support is an evidence-based practice, but there are a lot of specific activities that peer support do that we don't have a ton of evidence for, because as peer-run organizations go, we're not historically super well adept at collecting, aggregating, and evaluating data. So we're bringing in highly skilled evaluators on contractual basis, which we're really lucky to be able to do. We write that into any grants that we apply for. And then, like I said, we're bringing on a staff member whose primary role will be that going forward, so that when someone comes on, they take an initial survey, they take a 6-month survey, and they take a discharge survey, where we're actually able to see change in behavior, change in motivation, and change in overall outlook, because I think all three of those things are important when it comes to long-term recovery.
Absolutely. And I think it's a great point to make that you write that data collection piece into your grant, because I know that is such an overwhelming part of what we all have to do for sustainability. So to make that point that it is something that you write in, so it's not something that you all have to worry about, but now you are deciding to hire someone to do that for you, is wonderful.
Yeah, well, we were awarded a grant where we wrote a whole person in for that. So that's exciting for us.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Rich, I would love to hear your perspective on that. And if you guys do anything that is maybe a little different than what Sadie has spoken to.
When it comes to, you know, tracking the data, you know, we've been tracking it from the beginning, and, you know, and hearing about Sadie's program is just amazing. Like, I would say, like, our program is fledgling compared to that, right? There's no actual staff member that's doing this. This is all based on grants given to the county, and no one who works with us, including me, is a county employee. Right. So we're all, like, I'm a consultant, and so are the coaches. But we do track data from the beginning. We do an intake, and we need this information, like you said, like Sadie said, you know, to really prove that, you know, with evidence that this is working and that it's, you know, worth doing. Not only is it working, and it's a proven model that the more money that's provided, the more success we get. And so, you know, initially the data was proof of concept, and then we provide all of the data as a, you know, requirement of our grant funding to the Attorney General's office to continue the grant funding. And, you know, recently we switched to how our data is captured into RDP, it's called, which is the recovery data platform offered by FAVOR, Faces and Voices of Recovery, you know, through the Attorney General's office. So that's we've been provided licenses for that for free. And, you know, I've been on calls and learned that other counties don't like the system, but I actually have a systems background. So I, again, with change manager, can bring anyone along in the system. But I think one of the great things about it is, in this new system, is as long as everything is being input regularly, we have data available, you know, immediately. So once it's put in there, reports can be run instantly, and our grant funders can actually look in the system and see what's going on themselves. So the system, it can be, you know, adapted to specific needs, and, you know, it's been through a number of iterations. So I'm glad to get a system that's not the 1.0 version of the system. And, you know, with the addition of grant funding, though, you know, all that being said, you know, with the additional funding from COSAP, we hired Rutgers University, the State University of New Jersey, their Walter Rand Institute, to evaluate our data. As now that our program is much larger, you know, we're excited to partner with them and, you know, to see what the data can tell us so we can improve upon, you know, what we're doing for the county residents.
That sounds great. It sounds like the RDP has really streamlined things for you all, and both of your organizations have partnered with PhD students. So that's wonderful as well. And I think that that can be something that's utilized for other programs as they're kind of looking to figure out how to make this work if they don't have access to the RDP or didn't, you know, initially write that into their grant. So I appreciate both of your perspectives on that. And I think it's incredibly educational for some of our listeners.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To learn more about how COSAP is supporting communities across the nation, visit us at www.cosapresources.org. We also welcome your email at cosap@iir.com.